This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Pierre Delancey. It is almost 20 years since contemporary art took a participation turn. Now, just about every museum and theatre company has an engagement or outreach department. And it is nothing short of orthodoxy that one of art's core missions is to reach out to audiences beyond art institutions. Paradoxically, it is often art institutions that mandate dysfunction. How can we reconcile the somewhat forgotten history and ongoing practice of the community arts movement with the recent rise of participatory art, social practice, or outreach and engagement? Well, these are some of the questions posed by A Restless Art, a 2019 book by François Matarazzo. François Matarazzo is a community artist, writer, and consultant, and I'm very happy that he joins me now to discuss his work. François, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Pierre. It's very nice to be here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. François, we normally ask authors to start by introducing themselves a little bit to the audience, but I have a feeling many of our listeners will already know of you and of your work, partly through, I guess, a notorious paper from 1997 entitled Use of Ornament, which is one of those things that in all academic matrices has thousands of citations. I mean, it's probably difficult to find a master's thesis in cultural studies that doesn't cite your work. But I think it will be very important to maybe locate that and put that to one side before we get into talking about the book. And maybe you could start by introducing your broader interests and your work, well, before and in the 20 odd years that have passed since the publication of that paper.
Okay, so I'm a community artist, by which I mean that I continue to work and think in the line of community arts that I first encountered at the beginning of the 1980s, when I was taken on as an apprentice community arts worker at Greenwich Mural Workshop and began to learn about the practice and the theories behind it. For me, the term community artist or community arts worker, I might even prefer, it has an importance in a number of ways. First of all, I always have to explain to people that I'm not an artist. I don't make any work myself. I have no practice, to use the word that's become standard. I only work with people. And part of my thinking is that community art is not a different way of doing an existing art form, but an art form of its own. It's a different form. So I worked as a community artist up until the mid-1990s, when the questions that I was asking myself about the work were becoming more urgent, and I had the opportunity through being introduced to a group of consultants and researchers called Comedia to undertake some research into not just community arts, but the wider context of participation in the arts and the social impact of that, which I had seen in my own work and in work of colleagues and peers. So that research was published in 1997. And I've written about it in the part of the new book that deals with history, because it's, I think, as you have indicated, it's become a kind of unavoidable marker on the road of participatory and community and socially engaged work. I think that it's become a marker positively, I suppose, and I'm of course the person least qualified to judge, but positively, I think, in at least two senses. One is in establishing a series of concepts about what the social impact of participation in the arts might be. And secondly, in giving practitioners, people who work in this field, a lot of tools and confidence about how to think about their work. And to some extent, I think those were both things that I hoped to do. For some people, it's become a negative marker because they associate it with political ideas they don't agree with, and ascribe to it and me intentions that I don't have. And consequently, you won't be surprised to hear me say that, I think it has been widely misread in some quarters, and I think it's been more often cited than read.
That's for sure true. But I think we should get to that detail later on as we untangle some of the histories that you tell in the book that pertain to the rise and then the rise and the rise and rise again of what you term participatory art. And I think it will come across very quickly to our listeners and to anyone who reads this work in particular, that actually your intentions were nowhere near any of the readings of use of ornament. So I think it would be good to start just by giving a brief sketch of the kind of terminology that you give in a book. And I really appreciate that you did this here, because what becomes quite apparent very quickly is that despite the rise of interest in participatory and community art over the last maybe 15, 20 years, actually a lot of the research that exists really comes from a completely different set of perspectives that the community that you represent and which you are giving voice to in your works.
The definitions are important, I think, to me, because this is an amorphous area. The idea of making art with people has been interpreted and imagined in many different ways, and there is a plethora of terms, from socially engaged practice to applied theatre to relational aesthetics and on, all of which are, I think, primarily talking to the art world and seeking to distinguish one brand of practice from another, and almost to colonize a certain territory and associate it with a school of thought or a school of artists. Those, all of that language has the second big problem for me, which is that nobody that I might want to be involved in a project I was working with would understand any of those terms. So in the book, I had to decide what language I would use and to recognize that although I still hold to the term community art, partly because, as I've said in the book, I think that it relates to a particular set of theories and practices that I think are important, I also recognize that there is this much bigger field. So I had to have a term for the much bigger field. And I settled on the term participatory art. And for that, I needed to give it a definition that was both precise but large enough to embrace everything that it might include. So my definition of participatory art is very simple. It's the creation of art by professional and non-professional artists. And already that is changing the language and the terms that are often used, because it's much more common to talk about artists and ordinary people or participants or regular folk or whatever somewhat often condescending term the art world chooses to apply to the people that it doesn't recognize as being valid creators. I think that the only way to be an artist is to make art. So if you're involved in the creation of art, you are an artist, in the same way that if you're involved in cooking, you're a cook. If you're involved in gardening, you're a gardener. It's not a value judgment. You may be a bad gardener or a bad cook. You may be an extraordinary cook. The term applies to the action, the act in the world that is gardening or cooking or making art. So I think that everyone who is involved in participatory art is an artist, but there is a significant difference between a professional who brings a training, a context, an education, experience, skills, and hopefully talent that they've acquired over time, and that gives them a professional context in which to make judgments about their own work and to its relationship with a field of practice. And then non-professional artists clearly don't bring those things, but they bring other things. They bring an open mind, what in Buddhism is sometimes called a beginner's mind, the ability to challenge received ideas, to say, why do we think about it like that? Why are we doing it in this way, when actually there isn't a good answer, except that the professionals have been doing it like that for a long time and may have forgotten why they're doing it like that, or it may be a convenience that is no longer being thought about. So that the non-professional brings an open mind, fresh ideas. They also bring knowledge and experience, but it's a different knowledge and experience. It's a knowledge of their situation, their life, their identity, the things that might be part of the resources that they are bringing into the creation of the work. They also often bring not just something to say, but a need to say it, because they don't take for granted that this is an opportunity they will always have. In one of the projects that I talk about in the book, for instance, a theatre performance by the theatre company Grey Eye called This Is Not For You, made by professional artists working with 25 disabled veterans of the armed services. And talking to some of those veterans afterwards, it was very clear that their motivation was to have the story of disabled veterans heard, because they feel that it's often almost an embarrassment, a political embarrassment. They wanted to be heard, and this was a powerful way for telling that story. But they didn't want to be artists or to make art again, so that they seized the opportunity that they saw to make the art that mattered most to them. So that combination of professional and non-professional, when people work together, they make work that neither of them could make alone, and that therefore has forms and meanings that are new in the world because of that relationship.
So the other set of terms that you introduce, which is actually what I think inspires where we've got to now, is community art. And I wonder whether we could disambiguate participatory art and community art, and to do that for the purpose of thinking about the intentions which those two practices might have behind them and what brings rise to the different manifestations.
So the concept of participatory art, as I've outlined it here, it is intentionally very broad. And for me, one of the examples that I often use to as a marker of one, it's probably not the end of the spectrum, but towards one end of the spectrum, would be the work of Spencer Tunick, who's a photographer who has a practice of taking photographs of thousands of naked people in public spaces. He's made these projects in all over the world. He invites people to come, take off their clothes, be told where to stand, sit, lie down, and be photographed. And it is irrespective of whether you think the work is artistically interesting or not. The point is that the artist is in complete control of that situation. And frankly, it doesn't matter which 3,000 people turn up, so long as 3,000 of them do, because they make no contribution except by being there. So the non-professional artists in that sense are material for the artist to work with. Now, I also have to recognize, because I've read some of the accounts that people have participated in his work, that some people find this profoundly moving and important, and indeed some people willingly travel the world to be in a Spencer Tunick photograph. So I respect that. So I make no judgment, and it's important that the concept of participatory art, as I said before, about being a good cook or a bad cook, you can be a good participatory artist or a bad participatory artist. And in the book, I've talked about my ideas about how we might assess artistic quality, what the criteria might be. But it's separate from the idea of a definition. Definitions are about, they're not value judgments. They are about trying to identify a thing that is different to other things. Then that helps you then to recognize that thing and recognize other things. So this field of participatory art is very broad. But my work I describe as community art, and it is a much narrower field, and it is a more demanding field. So the definition of community art that I offer in the book shares some of the characteristics of the definition of participatory art, but it adds a number of imperatives and strictures that I'll explain. So the definition is: community art is the creation of art as a human right by professional and non-professional artists, cooperating as equals for purposes and to standards they set together, and whose processes, products, and outcomes cannot be known in advance. So the central idea of the creation of art by professional and non-professional artists remains there, but it adds that this is a human right, picking up Article 27 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which gives us all the right to participate in the cultural life of the community and to enjoy the arts. The other three ideas are that the professionals and non-professionals are cooperating as equals, therefore clearly not the Spencer Tunick model. They are doing so for purposes and to standards they set together. Again, the participants in a Spencer Tunick piece do not set the standards or the purposes, and whose processes, products, and outcomes cannot be known in advance. The reason that you can't know the processes, products, and outcomes in advance if you are making community art is because if you do know those things, you are not cooperating as equals, because you have in effect defined the project that then other people have to fit in or take their clothes off and lie down in front of. So those three ideas were my attempt to try to define what I thought was critical about community art, about everything that I've tried to do in my working life. And they are part of why I think use or ornament has been misunderstood, because I think in my naivety 25 years ago, I believe that people understood those principles. I know better now, which is why I had to spell them out in that definition. But let me make it a bit more concrete by giving you an example from something I've done recently. In fact, I'm still working on. I was asked to do a creative writing workshop in Boston, in Lincolnshire, which was due to happen last spring. And then, of course, the lockdown happened. It was commissioned by Writing East Midlands and Transported, which is a local organization. And the intention was to work with people aged over 55, and that it would lead to some kind of artwork. But there was no expectation or decision about what that might be. The work, it moved onto Zoom, and it started in January 2021. So I was in France. The people who joined the group, there were five people who joined the group, and we met on Tuesday evenings. They joined the group from different parts of different places around Boston. And I had given the project the title Wish You Were Here, which had originally come from the idea of a seaside postcard. Boston is close to the seaside resorts of Lincolnshire. The postcard is an interesting example of perhaps the earliest form of social media, something which combines a text and an image, and which is semi-public and semi-private, and once sent can have consequences that were not anticipated. So I went just with that idea in mind, and something to do with the wistfulness and the ambiguity of the phrase "Wish you were here," and I wrote an invitation for people to come and join in. The first person who came, in fact, only one person came on the first workshop. He had come and he'd written a beautiful, very poignant poem about his ambiguous feelings about the fair in Boston, which in the past he had often seen as a nuisance, noisy and smelly and disruptive, but now felt very differently about, as because it couldn't happen. And the poem he wrote was really great. And it set the tone then for what became 10 weeks of writing. And I could not have anticipated. I had five gifted and committed writers who brought new work to each session and who shared it willingly with each other on Zoom, although they didn't know each other, and commented on each other's work. And it was fairly clear within 6 or 7 weeks that the artwork we had was a book. And that is what we've now edited. We're meeting again next week. We also have found an artist who's drawn some fantastic illustrations, and the book will be published this summer in Boston, and we're hoping to do a reading. They will do a reading. I won't be there. None of that was anticipatable. It has come from who was there. It couldn't have been commanded by anyone in advance. And what people make of it, what value they find in it, I'm confident they do find a lot of value in it because they've told me so, but it's entirely personal to them. So that's kind of what I mean. And when I say, again, a final point in terms of cooperating as equals, so I've edited their texts because I am a more experienced writer than them, but it has been done with the absolute commitment that if they don't like any of the suggested edits I've made, they are the writer, and we will use whatever form of words they choose. So they have the right to reject anything that I suggest. So that, I think, in a very small, simple project is the maybe the difference between participatory art and community art.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
That's a beautiful project that you've just described. And I think it illustrates quite clearly one of the keys to me of differentiating between the two approaches, which is the issue of authorship. You just described as the leadership and the creative control. And I think it would be really beautiful to get to your argument about which aspects of community or participatory arts are worth learning what from. But to do that, I want us to spend a moment thinking about the kind of intentions and frameworks with which people approach all these things. And you list broadly three ideas that, and these are to do with cultural democratization. So that's increasing access to art, like spreading the joy of art in lay terms, social change with myriad definitions and myriad meanings, and also the advancement of cultural democracy.
The democratization of culture has been the foundation of cultural policy in Europe since the end of the Second World War. But actually, it has older roots that are important. And in fact, since I wrote the book, I see that I missed a connection, or I've only seen a connection that I should have seen earlier, which is that essentially the democratization of culture, which is, as you quite rightly say, the principle of extending access to the art. So the great post-war French theatre director, Jean Vilar, behind the National Popular Theatre, argued, as have other artists at that period, that the arts should be a public service, like health, education. It should simply be there, available for people to have. On the face of it, it's an admirable ideal, but it makes some assumptions that I find difficult to accept, one of which is that art and culture are a fixed thing, and that they are universal and speak to everyone. The connection that I hadn't made when I wrote the book, of course, is that the democratization of culture is, in effect, a 20th century version of the 19th century civilizing mission, a mission civilisatrice, the idea that the powerful Western European nations gave themselves, that it was their duty to civilize the rest of the world through colonialism and empire. So I think what the democratization of culture and the civilizing mission have in common is that they are both essentially faiths. Their advocates believe in a certain form of culture, the culture that by strange coincidence is theirs, and that they, as believers, honestly and with the best intentions, feel that everybody should be converted to. In the book, in the historical part of the book, I talk a bit about the 1960s, which, and this is partly my generation, but I think it's also true, still casts a great shadow over the world that we now live in, because the 1960s, in all kinds of ways, the generation that reached adulthood in the 1960s, in most of the Western democratic world at the time, found the idea of this faith unacceptable, or at least they didn't accept that they should just accept it. They didn't necessarily reject all of its values or ideas, but they claimed the right to decide for themselves what authority it should have in their lives. One of the responses to that was the community arts movement, and politically and theoretically, the response was the invention of cultural democracy as a term. And interestingly, an American friend recently pointed out to me, which I didn't know and need to research more, that cultural democracy as a term was being used in the United States in the 1920s. So it may well, that's something I need to try and understand. But in a European context, as far as I can trace it, it emerges in a conference of cultural ministers organized by the Council of Europe in Norway in 1974. And when you read the proceedings of that conference and the preparatory papers, it's very clear that these cultural ministers are reacting to the shock of the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s. They say we have been told that our idea of democratization is unacceptable, that there are other cultures that we have neglected and marginalized, and we need to rethink that. The difficulty with cultural democracy is that it's much harder to define than cultural democratization. It's really easy and snappy to say culture should be a public service like education. Everyone can get that idea. The idea that everyone should have access to the opera, to galleries, it sounds like a self-evident good as well as being a simple notion. Cultural democracy has struggled to define itself coherently and in ways that would allow for the development of a program. It faded in the late 1980s as part of the rise of neoliberal dominance, has recently reappeared in cultural discourse in the last 5 years, mostly in the English-speaking world. But I'm not convinced that there is a very clear understanding of what it did mean or what it might mean today. I think it's often being, I don't want to say appropriated because it's unkind. People are gravitating towards it with good intentions and optimism, but I think there needs to be a lot tougher thinking about what it means and what its implications are.
Recently, maybe you've already come across this text, Stephen Hadley published a monograph on audience development, which is just kind of a coded word for exactly what you're talking about, culture democratizations. And one of his first observations was that if culture needs to be democratized, that's by definition an acknowledgement of the fact that it is not democratic. But maybe I could ask you to go into some detail of the, God, I have to say with some shame, to my generation of people who are more situated in the contemporary art sphere. The community art movement is a kind of under-researched, under-described, unknown entity. But I think it would be great to have a couple of examples of things that have not necessarily been reproduced and the current manifestations of participatory community art that you see. So maybe it would be good to find some things too that we lost that might be worth thinking about again.
It's not surprising to me that the community art world is very little written about by academics or critics. Indeed, one of the reasons that I originally did the work that became Use or Ornament was not because I particularly had an intention or a wish to become a researcher, But having been working in this field for, by then, about 15 years, I was frustrated by the complete lack of interest of researchers. I would challenge you to find any serious treatment, academic treatment of community arts before the year 2000. There just wasn't anything. And so the work I did was a conscious acknowledgement that we would have to do it ourselves if anything was going to be done. But of course, I wasn't surprised because I have always understood community art as being a radical and political movement. And in the 1960s and 70s, it described itself as the community arts movement. But I think that now, and sometimes at the time, there were people who thought that was a political movement in the broader sense. I didn't take that view and don't take that view now. I think its radicalism and its political project was directed at the art world, not at the political world. In other words, it set out to challenge, in the same way as other forces in the 1960s, the authority of the art world to decide what was good and what wasn't good. And I put it like that because that is the only question that really matters in terms of art. What is worth something and what isn't worth something? And if arts councils, academies, institutions of the art world can be shown not to have a coherent analysis or way of thinking about that, then it begs questions about what are they for. If they can't explain and justify what's good and what isn't good and what should be paid attention to and what shouldn't, then really there's no use for them, because that's their only thing that the rest of us could actually need from them. And consequently, the struggle in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, but that's when it petered out for wider political reasons, that struggle was exceedingly bitter. And the art world, the institution of the art world, needed to protect its authority and its judgment. So when the community art world said, you have to look at this work in its own terms, that was not an argument that made any sense. So, for example, I think the book that we will publish, that the Boston Writers will publish this year, I think it's a really good piece of writing. I'm really surprised at the quality of and the connections between all the pieces. But if you put it up for the Booker Prize, and it was assessed on the same terms as that, you would not put it at the top of the pile. But that's to try and judge it outside of its context and by rules that and criteria and intentions that no one involved in it chose or aspired to or had any interest in. So that remains, I think, for me, at the heart of why community art is vital and radical, because that argument has not gone away. What do we mean by what's good, and who gets to decide what's good? That really matters because, as I say in the book, art is a meaning-making system, and who controls the meanings that we make out of our experience and our existence shapes how we then act in the world and how we behave, how we imagine and construct the world, how we work together. And in the book, I open the book by talking about the normalization of participatory art, because in the 40 years I've been working, participatory art, but not, I stress, community art, has come in from the margins. And now the Tate Gallery, every theatre and orchestra will be using participatory art, the language of participatory art, and doing participatory projects. But I think it's really important to understand that almost all of that work is doing a task of democratizing culture. It is pursuing a civilizing mission under the appearance and the methods of community art.
This is the kind of crux. I mean, much has been written about the cultural politics of the UK since 1997, which just happens to be also the first year of the new Labour government that has brought increased funding for the arts. I think one of the many misreadings of your 1997 paper is that it sort of advocated and led to the removal of social functions of the state towards artistic community, which of course that idea stood in great contrast and in conflict with the gatekeeping, as we would term it, gatekeeping aspects of the art world. But I think we've turned it out, and you do recognize this in the book, because I still see a great element of hope in your treatment of the last 20 years. I think we're at a point where the participatory art and all its problems, its connection to this kind of democratizing, civilizing, is now completely at odds with some of the political and radical and emancipatory desires of a generation of artists that are being deployed to perform this work. So to put it very crudely, we might have had a generation of artists who were reluctantly recognizing that we're not going to become the YBAs and hit market success, and were somehow being channeled into participatory art, participatory practice, like ameliorative social work. But now I'm beginning to sense that the artists themselves are much more interested in their own community.
I think what the normalization of participatory art means is not that the battle for justice, equity, fairness, social change is over, but that its terms have changed. And it now has to happen in different ways on a different basis. And that's where I hope that the definitions and the concepts that I've proposed in the book will be helpful to artists. It is possible to do work, honorable work, in all sorts of ways, including most that I have no interest in personally, but that doesn't mean that the work can't be good and honourable and valuable in terms of the people doing it. What I think matters, though, is that people have an understanding of the territory in which they are working, and that understanding helps them not mislead themselves as to what they are doing and why and what its effects are likely to be. This is somewhat paradoxical, and I'm aware that it's maybe even a slightly absurd thing to say, given that I have spent all of my working life working in the arts. But I do not think I'm part of the art world. I don't have any interest in it. I don't belong to it. It's not where my priorities or motivations lie.
Well, a question that I have, partly out of interest in my own research, is that of education and then making arguments for resources which are connected. You do touch on it in a book. How do you see the politics of the cultural industries as they have played themselves and how they're playing themselves out? But we've got to the point where we're under certain stress for various political reasons. We're also at a moment where the arts have to be able to demonstrate the contribution to society and make some kind of positive contribution, a recovery. And what I find very, very difficult is to see that the arguments being put forward are either incredibly abstract or they are financialized. And at that point, of course, in the latter, the battle is lost, because I don't think we can use an economic argument towards politicians who already have the economic argument on their desk and are reading it in a very different way.
I think one of the things that has always shaped my thinking about the art world and the arts more generally is that there is no reason to expect it to be proof against the inequalities and injustices that exist in every other aspect of society. But I think that the art world sometimes forgets that. It reproduces the same social structures and systems that are found everywhere, and that's also true of education. But you place this into a bigger context. I think it's certainly been my view since the beginning of this pandemic that we are living through a historic change, but it's also, I mean, I have thought since 2008 that the events of the financial crisis then already marked the intellectual and political bankruptcy as well as the financial bankruptcy of a certain system. And I think that everything that has happened in Western countries since then has been the playing out of the collapse of a certain settlement and attempts of those in power to try to either prevent that collapse or to use it to their own advantage. The pandemic comes on top of that. And I think anyone who believes that they can anticipate the shape of our societies, even in the very short term, is on thin ice, shall we say. I wrote a blog last year in which I floated the idea that we may have reached peak culture. The quantity and importance of culture has been growing extraordinarily through the course of my professional life. One of the examples I cite in the book is that in 2012, I think it's about 400, I think it's 451 new museums were opened in China in 1 year. 451 new museums. There are reasons for why that has happened, and I touch on them in the book. But it is possible that one of the reasons, for example, is the decline of political and religious ideology as meaning-making systems, which has left culture as the predominant meaning-making system in wealthy in the wealthier parts of the world. But that was never irreversible. And populist politics, nationalist politics, may be creating new meaning-making systems and succeeding precisely because of people's need to find meaning and to interpret their experience. And I can see that for lots of people, a clear political narrative is more compelling than a piece of contemporary art if you're looking for a way of understanding your life and what's happening to it. So I don't know. When I say that I don't think I'm part of the art world, it's because I don't believe that art is the purpose of life. I think human beings are the purpose of human beings, and the quality of the life that we can have is what really matters. And art can contribute to that, but so can good housing, so can good healthcare, so can good occupations and many other things. So I remember I once asked somebody, I better not mention his name, but he was a significant figure in the British art world at the time, who was making a case for more funding for the arts. I asked him how much art was enough, and he brushed off the question as impertinent, which it perhaps was. But it's also an important question. I mean, one of the things that's extraordinary now is that, as Clive James wrote in Cultural Amnesia, Beethoven and Monet never saw all of their works together. Beethoven could never hear, sit and listen to all his works, even before he went deaf. And now we can have anything, anywhere, any time, and for nothing. And I wonder what that means about that consumer culture. But the culture that I write about in the book, the culture that I care about, the five people I was working with in Boston to make stories about their experience of place and this strange time of lockdown and the COVID situation, that book may never have more than 200 or 300 readers, but there'll be people to whom it speaks because they also live in Boston or near Boston. They also live through those experiences. They have some connection that means that the sense-making that artwork is about contributes to their sense of sense-making. Sorry, I'm using words like sense and meaning in multiple ways. So if you've followed me this far, you're very bright. But that work, we're very far from reaching the peak of that, because that is the work that people want to do for its own sake, not for a career, not for a reputation, not for money. And so, paradoxically, although I've often been accused of instrumentalizing the arts, I think I'm the person who believes in it much more than many of the people who've criticized me on those grounds.
Well, certainly your enthusiasm is testament to the value of this work. I want us to, towards the end of a conversation, to look at a couple of examples and maybe ask you for some advice. And as much as your book isn't exactly a DIY manual, you do point to some initiatives and practices that you think are worth bearing in mind and replicating. And one of those that you return time and again in the book is fun palaces. So maybe you could speak a little bit about those.
What has made fun palaces so special? Fun palaces is an idea which has become a movement. It was an idea to celebrate the centenary of the birth of Joan Littlewood, who was one of the totemic figures of the early cultural democracy and community arts movement, although I don't think that she belonged to either of them, actually. Stella Duffy suggested organizing a fun palace, which was an unachieved dream of Joan Littlewood, to build a fun palace, which probably would have been of just a very big art center with some strange things going on. But at the time, in the 60s, there were lots of places where strange things were going on. The genius of fun palaces was that Stella, who's a great writer and not an arts manager, although in setting up fun palaces she had to become one for a while, and she's recently stepped down and handed it over to other people. But she was an inspirational person because she could give people the idea that on the weekend that was the anniversary of Joan Littlewood's birth, which is the first weekend in October, people could organize their own fun palace. And actually, the ambiguity of what that meant was immensely empowering, because fun palaces has become a movement that is principally about people sharing their skills, their enthusiasms, their creative knowledge with other people, entirely unpaid, unfunded, self-organized, and powerfully transformative. One of the most impressive things about fun palaces is how much more accurately their members, their makers, as they call them, the fun palace makers, reflect the actual demographics of society much more closely than the people who attend the arts funded through public funding. The reason that I love that, and I'll go back to another project which I've also mentioned in the book because it was so important to me, although it was 20 years ago, It was a project called Living Heritage, and it was a program that I worked on with a Belgian foundation in southeastern Europe of, in effect, doing community arts projects but without community arts workers, because we were working in places like Romania, Bulgaria, North Macedonia, Bosnia, places that had, in some cases, recently known conflict, were recently post-communist. There were no community arts workers to work with. And so we had to find alternative strategies. We were very clear, incidentally, that the purpose of this work was the third intention of community arts. It was about social change. It was about empowering people. And one of the most important things that we did in that program was to bypass the professionals. We gave grants directly to communities. Sometimes they had to form associations and open bank accounts because they didn't exist as associations already. I think hardly anyone that we gave a grant to had ever had a grant from anyone before. They proposed projects. They told us what they wanted to do, and we supported. We set no parameters. When at the beginning, when people asked me, "What do you mean by heritage?" I would come up with a really lame answer and say, "Well, it could be a museum, it could be traditional culture, it could be a food festival, it could be art." You know, it's terrible. After what working on the program taught me after a couple of years was that what mattered was that people cared about it. And so when people asked me afterwards, I just said, when they said, "What do you mean by heritage?" I'd say, "Heritage is whatever you care about. It's the caring that matters. It's because people care about something." It could be traditional secular gates in Hungary and Romania. It could be Turkish wrestling in Macedonia. It could be anything. It didn't matter. It's because it's important to people that they will then work on it, care about it, do all the things that make a project meaningful in their life. And I know, because I'm still in touch with some of the people that I met and worked with then, that some of those projects are still functioning now, 20 years later, without ever having had any more money from anyone. And so my main point, what's common to both Fun Palaces and Living Heritage, is trusting people to do what they want to do, not to decide what you think they should do, which is the democratization of culture vision, not to decide that they should like ballet, but to trust them to do what they want to do and then give them the money to do it with. That's what makes a difference. When we gave really small grants, and I have never forgotten the president of a Citaliște in Sofia. Citaliștes are a particularly Bulgarian form of cultural association, local cultural associations built around libraries. I spent half a day with them. They showed me all the things they'd done. They took me to see murals. I listened to the choir. I met the kids that had worked. And the president of the association, who was probably twice as old as me or getting there, it was very humbling to see his anxiety as he asked me, "Have we done enough?" He wanted to know whether they had been trustworthy, really. What I learned then and through that program was, of course, what Seneca wrote in one of his letters to Lucilius: the best way to make somebody trustworthy is to trust them. And that's how you bring about change. You don't think you know better than them. You trust people, and they will do everything to prove to themselves that they are worth being trusted.
Oh, well, yet another moving example of a beautiful practice. Thank you. So finally, I'd like to ask you about how you think individual artists can situate themselves within this kind of body of practice.
One of the questions I often ask young artists who are working with me is, to whom do you give the power to validate your work? And it often makes them sit up short, because framing it like that, I'm trying to get them to see that by caring about what somebody thinks of your work, you're actually giving them power over you and your work. And because I genuinely don't care what the art world thinks of me. I mean, I don't care in a hostile way. I'm just not interested. Then I just don't need to think about it. And it doesn't have any power over what I do. I care immensely what the five writers in Boston think of me and what we've done together, because they are the people I give the power to say this has been a good project or not.
Well, at this point, unfortunately, our conversation was interrupted by technical difficulties, but I was thankfully able to ask Francois to tell me later about his current and future research work.
So I've been thinking recently about what Article 27 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights actually means in practice. It gives everyone the right to participate in the cultural life of the community. But that's quite a vague phrase, important though it is. For example, I imagine that in China, in Russia, in America, governments would say, yes, we respect that right, but their understanding of what that means and the practice for citizens is likely to be very, very different. Last year, I worked on something called the 2020 Rome Charter with the City of Rome and United Cities and Local Governments, a network of local government organizations. And in the context of working on the Rome Charter, I looked at the capabilities approach developed by people like Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum. And in that, I proposed five capabilities that define what participation in cultural life of the community might be. And they are the capabilities to discover, to enjoy, to create, to share, and to protect culture. And you can find out more about the details of that in the 2020 Rome Charter website. But there's still work to be done on that. But I think that I'm seeing a clearer path to how this might offer an alternative form of policy to the conventional dichotomy between cultural democratization and cultural democracy. But I've still got thinking to be done about that.
Well, Francois, thank you so much for your time in the conversation.
Thank you.
Restless Art, Why Participation Won and Why It Matters by Francois Matarazzo is published by the Kalutz Gulbenkian Foundation and available as an open access download. I'm Pierre Delancey, and the editor is Marshall Poe. Thank you for listening, and join us next time.